Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:17 p.m. and that is Pacific's Standard Time. And today is Friday, November 16th. So it is the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, there are lots of big questions to be answered. Certainly, it's also a time that people have been asking a lot of questions. I just did the chart seminar in London, and it was an absolute pleasure to meet up with a number of subscribers, at least half of whom were. This was more than their first time of attending the chart seminar, and there were obviously a number of questions that were asked, which I think the vast majority of people are concerned with, the most important of which is this a secular bull market or a cyclical bull market? Particularly when we look at something like the Dow Jones Industrials Average, well, we can see, for example, that there was some evidence of acceleration last year. But I think it is worth considering that the largest share in the index is Boeing, and Boeing had very, very clear evidence of acceleration last year. So then the bigger question is whether it is representative to attribute the acceleration in one share to the entire index. When, for example, we look at the constituents of the index, it is very narrow. It's only 30 shares. When we look at the S&P 500 over the same time frame, there was certainly a pickup in the pace of the advance in the last couple of months of last year, but I think it would be a bit untoward to call that a climactic acceleration, but rather that it was evidence of some acceleration. It certainly increased the potential for a reversion back towards the mean, and that is in fact what we have had. But what is also interesting is that then that has translated into a clear rotation in terms of leadership that we've had within this market. So that's, I think, one of the more important points that is very clear within this. There's no, when we think about where the questions and answers are, well, the answer certainly is that we've definitely had an incredibly impressive cyclical bull market since 2009, and that's been characterized by liquidity. This has been a liquidity-fueled bull market. That's something that David and I have been saying now for almost a decade. So what happens in terms of liquidity is certainly going to have an impact on this cyclical bull market. And we've certainly had rotation. There's absolutely no equivocation about that. That when we look at, for example, the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, well, this has textbook type 2 top formation characteristics, and the leading share within it, which I think is not an exaggeration to say was Nvidia, has got very clear massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend characteristics. There was a loss of momentum this year. There were failed upside breaks. Now we've had the massive reaction. It was down 20% almost in here today. Well, I think anyone can see that there is a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean, and that is something that I think is increasingly becoming apparent to people that it is due a bounce. But even in the context that it gets a bounce, this is an incredibly climactic advance and indeed decline, and therefore it could take years before we get back up to towards those peaks. It's also worth highlighting that semiconductors are inherently cyclical in nature. When we think about it, there's nobody buying a subscription to semiconductors. That Nvidia had done frightfully well because of demand, not only from graphics, which is its primary business. That has obviously had a knockback because China has banned the introduction of new games into the market. So I think ostensibly to shutter the ability of Tencent to continue to advance. Because they were fearful that private companies were getting too powerful. But then you also had the fact that Bitcoin prices peaked almost a year ago, and have been trending lower pretty much since, and actually broke down to new lows in here this week. Well, that's not especially good news for the people that are selling the chips that allow for mining. So that's an additional consideration that's been weighing on the semiconductor sector. But the primary growth driver for the chip sector is in data centers, and that is represented by the cloud computing sector. Now, what's particularly interesting right now is that cloud computing is still holding on relatively well, and in fact, it's outperforming the Nasdaq when we look at it in terms of the consistency of the trend. The high back in March is approximated by the levels that we see today, and when we look at the Nasdaq, well, it looks relatively similar, other than the fact that the prices are slightly below where the peak was back in March. Well, there is obviously a little bit of difference in terms of the weightings of these two indices, where we have the mega caps that are represented by represent the primary weightings within the Nasdaq, and Apple, for example, has now unwound its overextension relative to the trend mean. It will look a lot better if it can push back above the trend mean, but at least it was off its lows in here this week. And we do have short-term oversold conditions. Amazon is also in the region of its trend mean, and it's been holding above this $1,500 area. Well, I think we're at a rather interesting area now, that we've had a sufficiently large rebound, and that it unwound about half of the decline that it put in from the peak in September. And now the question is whether it is now attempting at least to put in a higher reaction low. Google, which had been among the most consistent trends in the world, has become less consistent, but it still has got that progression of higher major reaction lows, and it is holding around this very psychological $1,000 level. Well, it does need to do better than that. It needs to be able to push back above the trend mean in order to really confirm that we have more than a short-term return to demand dominance, but it is also attempting to put in a higher reaction low in here. So this is, I think, a rather important area. But when we look at some of those other big caps, then Facebook, for example, made a new low in here today. So that has not yet put in a higher reaction low. But if it were to bounce next week, well, then I think people would perhaps start to think that the selling pressure has gone far enough. But certainly not yet. There isn't any evidence yet that this downtrend is over, and there's still a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs. Nonetheless, it is approximately $30 overextended relative to the trend mean, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we could get a bounce, even if we're in a bearish environment generally. But there is wider selling pressure on the social media shares, and part of the reason for that is because, of course, of their inability to police their ecosystems. Twitter has been the one that has been battling this problem for longest, and it's probably further along than the others in terms of its battling of the policing of its ecosystem. So it is exhibiting very clear relative strength at present. But I think that is an argument that should not be used to characterize the entire market. What we certainly have right now are a number of competing narratives for the market. So the semiconductors underperforming is one of those, because that is representative of a highly cyclical sector, and cyclical sectors generally do well in the latter stages of a bull market. Well, semiconductors and technology generally is a highly cyclical sector. So the underperformance now of the semiconductors index is a cause for concern in terms of the lead indicators for the consistency of this medium-term cyclical bull market. So that's one way of thinking about it. The other is that we've been due some rotation, that some sectors have been doing fantastically well, others not so much. But the other point, of course, is that interest rates have been rising. And if we did characterize this medium-term bull market as liquidity-fueled, well, then we need to pay some due consideration to the fact that liquidity conditions have been tightening. So when, for example, we look at the 10-year Treasury yield, it has broken out. But now it has pulled back rather sharply in here this week. So why would that happen? Well, it's because the Federal Reserve is beginning to talk about the pace with which it should be raising interest rates. And considering the fact that when we look at the Fed funds rate, they started raising interest rates at the end of 2015. They're due to raise interest rates again in December. That'll take the Fed funds rate up to 2.5%. And that's substantially below the peak that we saw in 2005 through, well, I guess 2006 and 7. And there's been a rivetingly consistent progression of lower major rally highs in the Fed funds rate since the peak in 1981, around 20%. Well, if the Federal Reserve decides that they are going to moderate the pace of interest rate hikes, then that is likely to be greeted by the stock market rather favorably. And that would also take some of the upward pressure out of Treasury yields. And that would, I think, be greeted by the bond markets as something that would be reasonably bullish. And then when we look at the yield curve spread, well, it's been rising over the course of the last few months. And it was in positive territory again in here this week. Well, it's still a really quite consistent medium-term contraction. And it would really require a very significant rally in order to question that we're not still in a contractionary environment. But that doesn't mean that it has to go negative imminently. And if we do see a pause in terms of the pace with which the Federal Reserve are raising interest rates, well, that could contribute to some widening of the spread, because the bond market has been grudgingly pricing in the potential for additional rate hikes. So they've priced in approximately two and a bit between now and the end of 2020. So, of course, that's an average rate, but what that would suggest is that they're going to raise again in December, and therefore the bond market is now pricing in that they will raise rates once on aggregate between the end of this year and the end of 2020, which is not a terribly ambitious forecast. So the bond market is already at the point where they believe that the Federal Reserve is not going to be able to raise rates without causing a contractionary environment. Now, when we look at affordability of housing, then that's, I think, something that gives us maybe an additional insight to where we are in terms of the Fed's thinking. And you can see, for example, that affordability today is approximating the levels that we had when prices were falling back in 2008. But prior to that, generally speaking, it was about the highest level that we had in terms of affordability between approximately 1993 and 2003. Well, of course, back then, the interest rate environment was considerably higher, certainly back in the early 90s, but in 2003, the interest rate was at approximately 6%. And today, the mortgage rate is at approximately, as excuse me, the mortgage rate in 2003 was at about 6%. The mortgage rate today is at approximately 5%. So, but prices are substantially higher today than they were 15 years ago. Now, of course, Wages have gone up since then, the economy has increased substantially since then, and the dollar's purchasing power has decreased substantially since then. So it's then the price of houses on a dollar for dollar basis is not directly comparable. But nonetheless, we've certainly seen that affordability is not nearly as affordable now as it was back in 2011, and part of the reason for that is because prices have appreciated, because interest rates have not gone up all that much, but they have certainly increased a lot if we look at it in terms of percentage terms, because the interest rate was way below where it is now. So if the housing market is starting to see some pressure, that we're starting to see price increases starting to moderate. Well, I received two or three phone calls in the last month from real estate brokers trying to get me to, or encouraging me to buy a house now rather than waiting until later. So that also tells us that there is some more inventory coming into the market and that these people who depend on commissions for their livelihood are getting a little bit more desperate because they certainly weren't calling me in the last year. Well, then that also tells us that there is some pressure coming to bear on the housing market. Then, of course, if we look at the home builders, they have been pulling back rather aggressively. There's no doubt that it accelerated down over the course of the last couple of months, and there is a short-term oversold condition. And we certainly had some evidence of acceleration at the latter part of last year. Well, not least because they were pricing in the benefits from the Trump tax cuts. Well, I think that has been completely priced out of the markets now because we're coming up to a time when people are starting to calculate what their tax liability is going to be for 2018, and the fact that the states where you have high prices and high state income taxes, like California, New York, and New Jersey, there's a lot of people are going to be losing their deductions. So that's a big consideration for the home building sector. Well, then when we think about that, there the Federal Reserve has I think an incentive here to be rather cautious about just how aggressively they raise interest rates, because if they are too aggressive, then they will end up with an inverted yield curve, and that would represent a lead indicator for a future recession. Well, the rationale behind that is because banks tend to make money when there is a wide positive spread in the yield curve, because they can borrow short and lend long. And when you get an inverted yield curve, they stop making money on that basis, and that inhibits credit creation at a time when interest rates are already rising. And when we look at the banking sector in the USA, well, what that tells us is that we're at a point now where banks probably need a little bit of assistance. The S&P 500 banks index had dropped below the trend mean, and so far it has failed to push back above it. So this is a rather do or die moment. It needs to push back above it. Well, we've had a medium-term corrective phase going on in the wider market since the beginning of this year. And there have certainly been some sectors that have been selling off more aggressively than others. Then, of course, we have interest rate sensitive sectors that have been selling off most aggressively, and it is in the highly leveraged sector where we've seen some of the greatest selling pressure. Well, the big banks have not been lending aggressively in the property markets. They have also been less aggressive in terms of the credit markets. But some of the smaller banks have really been selling off rather aggressively. And I've highlighted Bank of the Ozarks on a number of occasions because it really does look like a bank that is in rather severe pressure. And that it's an example of one of the banks that went from obscurity to international fame as a result of massive credit creation. So when interest rates start to rise, it starts to put pressure on these highly leveraged balance sheets. And that is also part of the reason why GE has come under such pressure. The price of the share has now been accelerating lower again. It certainly dropped down in a very aggressive manner from that overhead top formation, but now it is accelerating lower. And we know that acceleration is a trend-ending characteristic, but of undetermined duration. So it does suggest that the acceleration is not over. But what I find particularly interesting is when we look at some of the most liquid bonds that GE has, well, we're seeing acute acceleration here. Of course, GE's deterioration is going to be a case study in terms of economic theory for the foreseeable future. But for a company that used to be triple A rated and was prized by investors as a store of value, something that could be just bought and locked up and one could enjoy dividends, well, the dividends have been cancelled, and the credit right now is bordering on junk. It's trading like it's in junk territory. In fact, it's trading as if it's going to default imminently. But there's the world of difference between default and being downgraded to high yield. And when you look at something that has got a yield of 20.6%, well, then you've got to think that there's a lot of selling pressure has already taken place. And when we look at just how much of this debt is outstanding, well, we're talking about 5.7 tr million, excuse me, 5.7 billion. Then, if we look at the fact that it's paying coupons of 5% until 2021, and then it's going to go to 3 month LIBOR plus 330 basis points, and then if it is offered in exchange, so they could try and substitute a different issue. Well, the first one of those, the one that ends in BM4, is the GE 4% perpetual. And what we are starting to see is some buying evidence coming in for that. Well, what this is starting to suggest to me is that accelerations are, well, in fact, that is, if I maybe go to the shorter term, we can see that there was some buying pressure starting to come through earlier on in the day, but it didn't last all the way through to the end of the session. Well, what that I think is starting to highlight here is that some people at least are looking at something that would redeem at par, trading at 58 and with an extraordinarily high yield, and thinking, well, what is the realistic potential here that GE is going to default? That's a big question. Well, we know that it is likely to be downgraded to junk status, and it has a debt to equity ratio of approximately 200%. So with a market cap today of $70 billion, that would suggest it has 140 billion in debt. But that's not really the question, because servicing debt and refinancing debt are two entirely different prospects. And when we look at the maturity profile, well, there is some debt that needs to be refinanced next year, but there's no debt that needs to be refinanced imminently. Well, what that suggests is that the vast majority of selling pressure right now is occurring because of investment grade investors divesting themselves of it because they're fearful it's going to be downgraded. That will probably contribute to it being downgraded, but downgrading does not mean the same as default. And what that suggests is that you don't get 20% yields particularly often in something that has got the potential to trade its way out of trouble. The company has, or at least they say they have, $60 billion worth of divestments that they could make, and that's going to solve their debt problems for at least the next few years. And at 20% interest rates, well, on a total return basis, you can double your money in considerably shorter time than it takes for them to refinance. So What that suggests to me, at least, is that there is some extraordinary selling pressure that is going on right now and that it isn't entirely warranted. Well, it's usually when you see these kinds of very clear accelerations that that suggests that this is, we're coming towards the end of a corrective phase. Well, then the big question is what's going to happen on the liquidity front? If the Federal Reserve does in fact announce a pause after December, or if they say that they're not anticipating to raise rates four times or even three times in 2019, but perhaps maybe only once or twice, well then the market will take that as I think evidence that we're starting to get some real support starting to come through. Well, it is also worth highlighting that in terms of liquidity, approximately $1.25 trillion has been taken out of liquidity globally this year. And that's not even this year, it's really only since March. So that's the biggest unwinding of liquidity from central bank balance sheets that we have on record. And that's particularly important considering just how much credit creation we've had and liquidity that's been pumped into the market by various central banks. But we are potentially now at the end of the quantitative easing era. What are the main things that we've learned from quantitative easing? Well, the first is that it has been incredibly effective at inflating asset prices. We have evidence of that in the stock market. We have evidence of it in the bond markets, in the property markets, and in the art markets. The fact that Marie Antoinette's pearl pendant, because they weren't selling her pearl necklace, it sold at auction this week for, I think it was $33 million, and had an initial reserve of two. Well, that suggests that that's, I think, just additional evidence that we have ample appetite for asset price inflation in this environment. Well, that's also part of the reason why we've started to see that they've been coming back down in terms of backing away from quantitative easing, because yes, it has been wonderful at asset price inflation, but terrible at trickle down. Because the people who've benefited most from quantitative easing are those that had assets in the first place. And in other words, the people who needed assistance least profited from it the most. And that is no longer politically tenable. So what we have started to see in the USA now is a very smooth transition from extraordinary monetary policy to extraordinary fiscal policy. And that has helped to propel the stock market higher over all of 2016 and 2017. And now the question is, what's going to happen next? Well, the UK just this month has adopted a fiscally stimulative budget, and that has, for the short term at least, helped to sustain the FTSE 100 above this 17,000 level. Well, of course, the UK also has the additional challenge of what to do about Brexit. It's been my contention all along that whatever deal was negotiated was essentially going to be membership of the EU by any other name, and that that was nothing like what people thought they were voting for. So I think it's hardly surprising that we're getting some volatility now, because the chances of getting that kind of deal through Parliament, even in the best of times, was going to be rather difficult. So now the question is, what are the alternative solutions? Because it's unlikely the May administration is going to last. If there is an election, well, it's quite likely that the next administration could also represent a hung parliament, and that would still give us the same set of circumstances. If then, of course, the question is, what would a Labour-dominated government decide to do? They've been hedging their bets because they haven't been in a position where they have to come out with a very clear set of strategies, so they haven't done it. Then, if there is another referendum, and certainly an election might be deemed to be a referendum, but the problem, of course, is that having spent so much time negotiating the deal, it's going to be rather difficult to set up a set of potential circumstances where the deal is completely ignored. So you could either have a hard in, or so that they stay within the EU, or they have soft out, which would be to take the agreement. They could stay within the EU or decide to get a hard Brexit, or they could have a hard Brexit and or a soft Brexit, which is would be to effective to make effective the deal that's been negotiated. And form the question might take is likely to deeply affect the outcome. So that's, I think, some of the those are some of the conditions that are assailing the UK right now, and it is an incredibly uncertain environment. What we have seen, however, is that the UK is not Italy, and that is most acutely reflected in the bond markets. There was some loose talk that the UK is behaving like an emerging market, but that is just not the case. 10-year government bond yields have been pulling back over the course of the last month. Now, there is still a succession of higher reaction lows. But if the Federal Reserve decides to stop raising interest rates, then that's likely to act as a headwind for the dollar. And we've been short of arguments for exactly why the dollar should pause when we have a widening interest rate differential and there is just about nobody else raising interest rates in an aggressive manner, and the fact that the US economy has been outperforming. Well, those are also, I think, important considerations. But if the Federal Reserve decides to stop raising interest rates, well, then that will start to throw the focus back onto the performance of other currencies. I think it is also worth highlighting that central bank balance sheet figure that I've compiled is rebased to dollars. So therefore, when we look at it in terms of local currencies, it has to be borne in mind that the relative strength of the dollar, excuse me, I need to clear my throat. Sorry about that. The relative strength of the dollar has been a factor in the amount of money that has been taken out of circulation from central bank balance sheets. And if the dollar weakens, then that has a stimulative effect everywhere, not just in the USA, because it will make dollars available by making central bank balance sheets more valuable in their local currencies. So that's, I think, something that is worth bearing in mind, that if the dollar does not sustain its move above the trend mean on the dollar index, then that is likely to be a tailwind to assets just about everywhere. Well, I personally think that the UK will be able to weather the storm that's currently assailing it. But the pound is going to be an interesting prospect next week. It has pulled back in a very violent manner against the euro in here this week, and it is now pressuring the progression of higher reaction lows evident since August. Well, it was down in additional negative territory in here today, so it needs to bounce and bounce emphatically next week if the upward bias is to be maintained. But these are very large downward moves, and then if it fails at 112, well, then it is quite likely to go all the way right back down to the lower side of the range around 110 and may not stop there. So that would be the market pricing in the potential that the UK is going to have a hard Brexit. And I think that there is the potential for that at this stage. that when we look at what the potential outcomes are, and that the fact of the matter is that the people that were negotiating the exit from the EU had to almost to a person voted to stay in. So it is not so surprising that they have come up with a deal that is almost akin to staying in, and that is not at all what people thought they were voting for. But there is a logical answer for why the UK should be getting out of Europe, and it is because Europe has got some substantial problems, and that is most acutely apparent within Italy. Italy's populist administration, which is a hodgepodge of left-leaning and right-leaning parties, has contributed to the fact that 10-year yields are trending higher. So while we have seen yields starting to come back down, or at least easing in the USA and in the UK, that is just not the case in Italy in particular, and it does look like we're going to see some additional upward pressure on those yields. Well, Germany announced this week that it has had a negative growth quarter. And the performance of the DAX index is representative of that. It has broken down from that overhead top formation. Well, this has been a choppy uptrend from the get-go, and there have been some really rather impressive declines in the course of this advance, and this is another one of those. Well, it needs to hold the when I think the one of the big points from the chart seminar is that inconsistent trends are much less easy to analyze than consistent trends. And if we look at this trend, well, we can say yes, it has gone up a lot. The index went from a low of 4,000 to a peak just below 14,000, but it did it in what has been a very jerky manner. So now the question is it going to bounce again? And rather than think, well, that you have to give it more room because it is more inconsistent, well, we have to bear in mind that it has pulled back by in the order of 30% on two occasions, and sitting through 30% reactions is not particularly comfortable. More importantly than that is that when you sit through a 30% pullback, when do you sell? So that's a big question now for investors in Germany. And it highlights the point that the inconsistency of trends makes investing rather difficult because it makes the decision to sell all the more challenging. But what it also means is that when you do see prices doing well, and most particularly if they accelerate, well, then that is when you need to be thinking about taking profits. Well, now when we think about what the outlook is for Europe, well, there are enormous questions being asked about the integrity of the EU. And of course, it points to the internal contradiction that represents the market, that you can have one monetary policy for 27 fiscal policies, and that just does not make sense. But that is also a testament to the power of political will to hold it all together. So there is the possibility that with negative growth in Germany and the abject failure of Europe's auto manufacturing sector to predict the advent of electric cars and the evolution of batteries, that they're probably going to need some form of assistance because they're going to have to spend tens, if not hundreds, of billions of dollars to really get up to a pace, a place where they can compete internationally. What's particularly interesting is that all of the major battery manufacturers are either Chinese, South Korean, or from the USA. There is no big battery manufacturer in Europe, and that is despite the fact that it is the home to the world's largest automotive manufacturing sector. Well, this is another contradiction that China is now the largest consumer of automobiles, and the rules that they impose are going to have knock-on effects for the entire global sector. what's also interesting is that everyone is focusing on the underperformance of the semiconductor sector, but it is not the only technology sector. And when we look at, for example, the performance of some of these battery manufacturers, well, then they're going up rather than down. And that doesn't mean that this is the beginning of a new phenomenal bullish trend, but it's usually when you see relative strength after a big decline, then that gives us a clue as to what is going to lead us out of this corrective phase. And it does appear that it is batteries are going to do that. Then when and it's not so difficult to think about why that is. The simple fact of the matter is that the global economy is moving towards an adoption of batteries in a direct response to climate or fears about the climate. Also, the pressure that so many countries have felt from high oil prices over a prolonged period, and that has had an influence on consumption trends. So energy security and independence have become much more pressing considerations now than they ever were a decade ago, or in fact more like 2 decades ago. Then you also have the fact that China's air is absolutely awful. Then these are, I think, very important characteristics. We're definitely going to have more electric cars on the road. And that's therefore a good reason why these types of companies should be performing better. Even for Tesla, which is the most shorted stock in America, it's now testing the upper side of its range, and it has been exhibiting clear relative strength over the course of the last 6 weeks. It even had a positive return in October, when just about everything else was falling. Well, that must be one of the most contrarian signals that we've seen in a long time. Then, of course, you have the rollout of 5G, and this is, I think, one of the more important facts that is helping to propel Cisco Systems, also the fact that they adopted a subscription business model in the middle of 2017. So that is contributing to relative strength. Then when we look at the kinds of companies that are providing the actual bandwidth, well, Verizon has now completed a 5-year range and is continuing to exert relative strength. Well, I think it's not so difficult, therefore, to make a rationale for why that should be outperforming in this particular set of circumstances. Then 5G, of course, is going to be an enabling technology. So it's the kind of thing that will help to propel a whole slew of additional types of services. The gaming sector has been under rather extreme pressure over the last 3 weeks, and Activision Blizzard has been pulling back, and not least because of the ban on computer games in China. Well, one of the things that gamers argue about, or that they find most frustrating when they're playing online, is lag, because the speed of various internet connections is just not fast enough to keep up with the pace of the game. Well, that could be solved by 5G. It's also the kind of thing that could contribute to interactive TV, that people could pick their endings to various shows, and that's something that Netflix is looking forward to and potentially going to pioneer. And when we look at Netflix, it has pulled back below the trend mean. That one of the problems for Netflix is that it is a pioneer within its sector, but it's also reliant on debt financing, and its liquidity reliance is something that has really, I think, been a pressure on the share. It doesn't have the potential for margin expansion like Tesla does, if it in fact can master the manufacturing process. The problem for Netflix is that people tend to consume their content very quickly, so they have to continue to borrow more money to hire people to write and produce new shows all the time. And that is only, I think, a scalable business if they can continue to increase the number of people that are consuming it. Well, India is the obvious answer to that particular nugget, where you have literally hundreds of millions of people who have just been afforded 4G. Well, it'll be a while before India gets 5G, but interestingly now, Reliance Industries is bouncing from the region of the trend mean, and that's certainly encouraging. Well, what happens in China is obviously going to be a very important consideration, and they have been leaning on the shadow banking sector. They've been leaning on the regional banks. They've been cutting off dollar funding for the regional banks, and they've been attempting to curtail investment in the real estate markets. And I think it's fair to say that their results have been spotty because asset prices have continued to rise. Well, when we look at the stock market, well, the stock market is a, I think, a betting shop for Chinese consumers. And with the potential that China is going to loosen up in terms of its fiscal tightening that's been particularly underway since 2017, but really accelerated in 2018, the stock market is beginning to show signs of life. Well, it's still trending lower in a reasonably consistent manner, but it is now pressuring a key area of potential resistance here at the lower side of the overhead trading range. If we can start to see it pushing back above the trend mean, well, China starting to ease back on the pressure it's putting on its domestic economy to try and squeeze out some of the excesses would be good for the global economy. And what all of these factors are beginning to say to me is that we're coming towards the end of this corrective phase, that we would have to see things get measurably worse in terms of the things that people are worried about in order for this correction to deepen. And that's, I think, one of the most important considerations, because what we're starting to see is that central banks are beginning to make additional noises that they are willing to at least pause in terms of their tightening. And the response by governments to the rise of populism has been fiscal stimulus, that they need a set of policies that contributes to the trickle-down effect so that people feel like they're getting more money in their pockets, and fiscal stimulus is that answer. So there is the real potential now that we are going to transition almost seamlessly from extraordinary monetary policy to extraordinary fiscal accommodation. And if that is indeed the case, well, then that is likely to be inflationary. That should put upward pressure on inflation measures over time. That wage growth, for example, in the USA is increasing on a year-over-year basis. And that's, I think, one of the more important characteristics here, that inflationary pressures are starting to rise, but that central banks may be willing to tolerate a little additional acceleration. It would certainly help to unwind some of the massive debt piles that they have. The last thing they want is a recession, not least because they haven't been able to reload their interest rates to a point where they could aggressively cut them to combat deflationary forces, and they're much happier with mild inflation rather than deflation. So that's certainly a potential point. Then, of course, you have the fact that you have trade wars, and China is increasingly becoming more authoritarian. And if we look at the characteristics of the Chinese economy, then the parallels that we have between capitalism or communism with Chinese characteristics has a lot more in common with fascism than with a capitalist or liberal economic system. Simple fact of the matter is that China does not have respect for minority shareholder interests. We can see that abundantly with the warfare that is currently going on to try and contain the power of the private sector. If we look at the fate of some of the most high-profile CEOs, then Wang Jian is dead, Jack Ma is retiring, JD.com's CEO has been embroiled in a rape case, Pony Ma has had his has had Tencent, which is the primary social media outlet for China. It's had its primary revenue generating sector, the gaming sector, curtailed. Well, what that suggests is that to be a private company in China isn't a particularly welcome enterprise any longer. On top of that, the Chinese government has taken on a massive equity position within these private sector companies because so many of them had pledged their shares in return for debt, and the value of the shares has declined so much that the banks have been foreclosing on them. But of course, the banks are privately owned. The banks are not privately owned, they're owned by the government. And the banking sector has been bouncing over the course of the last 6 months, and it has been holding this progression of higher reaction lows. Well, it did pull back rather sharply last week, but again, it's been firming in here this week. Well, the measured way in which the primary banks have been moving higher over the course of the last 5 or 6 months is direct evidence of state intervention. Well, bull markets in China tend to be state-sponsored, and it does look like we're getting increasingly close to the next state sponsorship of a bull market in China, and not least because they're fearful about the impact of the measures that have been taken so far on the property market. A great deal of capital in China is tied up within the property market. It could be as much as 70% of the private sector assets within the country are in property. Well, there was news this week that 50 million units are vacant. Well, if that is indeed the case, and I really think that it is potentially accurate, considering the number of times that I've been to China in the last decade and everything that I've heard anecdotally, I'll never forget the time I was sitting on the plane next to a guy who was from Shanghai. He'd actually just been in Ireland, so we had plenty to talk about, and he was a logistics manager for Dell in Shanghai, and he was telling me that he owned 120 apartments and that they were vacant because he was simply holding them for capital appreciation. Now, this is not recently. This was approximately 6 or 7 years ago. So what that tells me is that there are large numbers of people who own multiple hundreds of apartments and that they're simply holding them for price appreciation purposes. The other point, of course, is that Chinese property is not delivered with second fitting. You're basically delivered a concrete husk where then you invest yourself in all of the additional second fitting to kit it out whichever way you want. But if you're holding it for price appreciation, you have no incentive to spend the money to bring it up to livable standards, which means that there are substantial numbers of properties in China are vacant but look completely run down because there's nobody paying maintenance fees, there's nobody has an incentive to make them look better until people actually in fact move in. But there's no prospect of anybody moving in unless there was a liquidation cycle. And then in a liquidation cycle, people wouldn't want to pay what was listed because the places look derelict, because they are derelict. So that represents a significant challenge for China. It also inhibits the just how I think committed they can be to trying to squeeze excess out of the system, because if they upset the property lending, borrowing, investing and selling merry-go-round, well, then that ex represents an existential threat, not just to the Chinese economy, but to the global economy. Well, therefore, it is China is the epicenter of risk. That is what we should really be worrying about. What we're presented with on Wall Street is a corrective phase. It looks like a medium-term correction, and there is the potential that if the Fed does in fact give us a somewhat more dovish tone, that we are coming towards the end of this corrective phase. Well, we've also had a significant rotation, and the kinds of companies that are being clearly favored are those that have got very solid cash flows. But that's also defensive. It suggests that, and it is defensive shares tend to do best in the latter stages of an advance. So we know we're in the latter stages of this medium-term advance, but it need not necessarily be over just yet. But that answers the question of whether this is a cyclical advance, but it's happening within the context of a secular advance. And we can see that in the Dow Gold ratio. The fact that we have over 100 years of history and that there is a cyclicality here, that there is approximately on average 35 years between the peaks, that each of those peaks is one above another, and that those massive outperformances of equities versus gold is have been driven by technological innovation. Well, there is no doubting that we are in a new technological golden age, that the evolution of batteries and of electric vehicles is likely to be a transformative effect on the global energy market, and that is cause for a bull market on its own. The evolution of 5G is something that is going to be transformative for the telecommunications sector, and what that will enable is the Internet of Things. It will potentially enable autonomous vehicles, and that is also something that can drive a bull market all on its own. Then, on top of that, you have the innovation that is happening in the biotechnology sector, where you have genetic editing and genetic sequencing, and the fact that the microbiome was only discovered in the last decade, that we are really only on the cusp of an incredible innovation cycle within the medical sphere. And again, that is something that could drive a bull market all on its own. And then, of course, you have AI, and the cloud is something that is likely to, if we I think put them all together, if you think about cloud computing, the rise of artificial intelligence and deep learning in computer systems, well, then the automation of processes is something that is likely to also drive a bull market. So there is ample evidence on the technology front and on the energy front that we are in a secular bull market. That there is no secular bull market is not punctuated by occasional recessions, and that we will have a recession, that there is no way that we're not going to have a recession. It will happen, but it will provide a very attractive buying opportunity from the perspective of a secular bull market investor. If we think about where the potential is for the next crash, well, the next crash is going to happen in somewhere that is the epicenter of risk. And I just don't think that today the USA represents the epicenter of risk. But China, it does represent an epicenter of risk. And so does Europe, because the contradiction that is inherent to the European project is going to continue to be explored by the markets, and it will eventually cause a crisis. So that is also something else to pay particular attention to. Well, if China's the epicenter of risk, and not least because of the extraterritorial ambitions of its increasingly fascist administration, then India is likely to be the country that benefits most from that. And the rise of the global consumer has probably already been priced in when we think about China, but there's nobody talking about catering hotels to the needs of millions of Indian tourists. That's just out there somewhere in the distant horizon. There's nobody talking about catering to the needs of African tourists. That's also out there on the horizon. That when you think about where the potential for consumer growth lies, it lies in the major population centers which have not already enjoyed it. So that's where we can anticipate that the big growth in productivity among large young populations is going to occur. Well, we've always got a changing environment internationally, globally, technologically, and socially. Well, the rise of populism is a direct response to the failure of centrism to contribute to the rising living standards of a majority of people. That ignoring the trickle-down effect, relying on debt to finance rising living standards through social security, well, that highlights more than anything else the problem with socialism that Churchill highlighted, that it works as long as you don't run out of other people's money to spend. Well, that is now, I think, being tested. Quite whether I think politicians have caught up to that fact is still very much to be argued with. But what it does suggest is that the bull market in debt is also something that is eventually going to end. And when we think about the total return on the 10-year Treasury yield, well, or on 10-year Treasury futures, what we have seen over the course of the last almost 3 years has been a progression of lower rally highs. Well, so far, we have not seen the end because it hasn't yet broken down. But a move below 2000 on this index would represent the end of a secular bull market in debt, whereas what it looks like right now is top formation development. Well, the top could take years to form if it's a type 3 top. So that is a potential problem in the future. It's almost a certain problem in the future, but it is not an urgent problem right now. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.